This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 96th in a series of interviews, and I am super pleased to have with me today Nate Fick. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Gary. Happy to be with you.
Nate Fick is the CEO of Endgame, a security intelligence company. He's also an operating partner at the Bessemer Ventures and a trustee of Dartmouth College. Previously, Nate served as CEO, COO, and fellow at different times of the Center for New American Security. Nate served as a Marine Corps infantry and recon officer, including combat tours in Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002, and in Iraq in 2003. He's the author of the 2005 New York Times bestseller, One Bullet Away. Fick and his platoon were the subject of a series of articles in Rolling Stone that became the book and the HBO miniseries Generation Kill by embedded journalist Evan Wright. Nate holds an AB with high honors in classics and government from Dartmouth, an MPA in international security policy from Harvard, and an MBA from Harvard. Nate lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife and two young daughters. He is a sailor and a fly fisher in his copious spare time. How much spare time is there, Nick? I did it. I just did the Nick Nate thing. I love it. Nate Fick always becomes Nick. Yeah. No, that's all right. How much spare time is there anyway?
I'll get out on the river for a day next week. I've been waiting for it for 4 months.
Oh, super. Which river are you going to do?
The Gunpowder up in Maryland. Nice native brown trout stream.
Oh, cool. So first of all, it's a great honor to have you on this show. Thanks for your service and for bringing back all your 89 Marines safely from Iraq.
It's an honor, Gary. Thank you.
Those of us in computer security have no idea what real war is like. And so we blithely throw around this term cyber war. And the question is, are we watering down reality just way too much? I mean, what do you think about that as an actual warfighter?
I see a bright red line between the kinetic and non-kinetic worlds, Gary. And I just think that philosophically, I learned my lessons in the kinetic world. And in the kinetic world, if you're going to kick the hornet's nest, you better be sure you're going to kill all the hornets. And in the cyber domain, for a whole bunch of structural reasons, I just don't think that's possible. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be very, very careful in how we talk about offensive cyber capability and how we talk about cyber war. And another bright red line for me is between the federal space and commercial. I think that they're wildly different conversations, and too often we conflate them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. We'll talk about more later in the show about that issue. Your book, One Bullet Away, is a great book. It's the only war book that I've ever read since the Colby war books about World War II when I was in fifth grade. And I really love those. What made you write that book? And is that motivation in any way related to the time that you spent with the embedded journalist? Or were those separate things? Is it the same?
Separate things, actually, and the book's dedicated to my good friend and comrade, Brent Morrell. Brent took over from me. He was my handpicked replacement and took my platoon back to Iraq in 2004, and Brent was killed leading the platoon on April 7th of 2004 in Fallujah in Anbar province, and I actually decided to write about the experience after Brent was killed because I felt like we Americans heard from generals, we heard from journalists, we heard from politicians, but we just hadn't heard much from the guys who were actually fighting the war. And just by virtue of timing, I was in the earliest phases of both the Afghan and Iraq wars. So I actually called and talked with Brent's parents and asked if they would be okay with me writing about the experience. And it was a story I had to tell, even if it was just going to go in my desk drawer and be something I'd show my kids someday.
Yeah, it's done a lot more than that, and so it's nice to have that kind of memoir available for people to understand the realities of what you guys all went through for us. Now, a question that's really utterly trite, but I think it's important. I actually want to know the answer to this. How's leading a startup alike and different from leading a combat platoon?
Not trite at all. I'd say combat and startup world are both characterized by euphoria and terror in rapid succession. I think I got spoiled in the Marines because people actually did what I said, and in startup world, that's not always true. But I actually think there are a lot of similarities. The basic tenets of leadership are kindergarten rules. They're the things that we all want. I had the privilege actually of working for some great leaders in the Marine Corps, and the best of them was the kind of guy who, if he told me, go up on the roof, do a swan dive off, and figure out how to stick the landing on your way down, I would have saluted and said, aye, aye, sir, and gone and done it. And I once asked him what his leadership philosophy was. I asked him to sum up for me why we all followed him through the gates of hell and were happy to do it. And he looked at me and he said, I'll give it to you in three words, Nate. Officers eat last. And for him, leadership wasn't about privilege. It was about responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so what did that mean day to day? It meant he kept us informed. It meant he was clear in his expectations, but he gave us a lot of autonomy. He told us what to do, but he didn't tell us how to do it. It was managing to outcomes, if you will. And I learned a lot from him. So, I don't set up machine gun positions or plan ambush patrols anymore, but a lot of the intangible stuff I learned in the Marines, I draw on every single day.
Yeah, that sense of responsibility for your people is really very clear in One Bullet Away. And I think it's an important lesson for all leaders to think about. I want to change the channel a little bit, or change our conversation a bit. So after that, you joined CNAS, the Center for New American Security, as one of the founding fellows, and you eventually became the CEO of that organization, and you were there for several years. What does CNAS do anyway, and why is it important?
So it's a nonpartisan research organization. I think many people would be surprised to learn how much of the thinking, cutting-edge thinking, innovation, policy formulation, how much of that's actually done outside the government. And where people aren't living their days driven by the tyranny of the inbox, where you can challenge conventional wisdom openly and not have to worry about the ramifications. CNAS was started by Michelle Flournoy and Kirk Campbell back in 2007 to try to bring together a critical mass of national security thinkers who were not aligned with any one political party, who were not in the pocket of industry, a place that could be a really independent voice. Mm-hmm. And every project we ever did was signed by individual people. The organization never took an institutional position, and it really focused on the leading edge of national security. So the intersection of national security and technology, the intersection of national security and energy and resource issues, the evolving importance of the Asia-Pacific region in national security. It's a young organization filled with young people, not necessarily young chronologically in terms of age, but fresh in their thinking and willing to challenge conventional wisdom. In a field where graybeards dominate, right, where often your credibility sort of moves in lockstep with your age. And we wanted to break that and build a different kind of think tank.
So you've explained what role think tanks play in Washington a bit, but can you put a finer point on it and explain what role they can and should play in helping guide cybersecurity policy in particular?
So cybersecurity is one of those places where, in my view, the solutions aren't going to come out of the government. You know, nuclear policy was developed largely in government and in government-funded research institutions because only governments have nukes, or at least, you know, at this point, 60 years into this nuclear game, we've been fortunate that only governments have nukes. Mm-hmm. Cyber's intrinsically different. It requires and will require a much greater degree of coordination and communication, collaboration between government and industry and companies. So I think that think tanks can serve as kind of a clearinghouse between companies, government, academics. I think there's a in the cyber conversation, we've got these four vectors that are moving in generally the same direction, but at wildly different speeds. You got the technology vector moving very fast.
Mm-hmm.
You have social norms moving somewhere behind the technology, but mm-hmm. still moving fast.
Playing catch up, really.
Yeah, but way behind those, I would argue, you've got the legal vector. The law is constantly trying to play catch up, and even behind the law, you have policy.
Yep.
So there's a conversation that has to happen out there on the bleeding edge of technology and social norms, ahead of the law, ahead of policy, and that conversation almost can't happen in the government. It has to happen someplace else, and I think that think tanks can play a role in developing that conversation.
Yeah, very well stated. I think if you think about the adoption curves of various technologies over the last century, you can see the problem that we're having. Because, for example, it took the telephone about, 70 years to get widespread adoption into 90% of the world. And electricity, it took even longer. That was about 120 years from what I can remember mm-hmm. from these curves. But if you look at the curve for the internet or mobile technology, smartphones in your pocket, the adoption curves are just astounding. They're straight up. You know, so we don't have time to adjust to the technology, and I think that's what you've described so well in that answer. I think that's exactly right on the money. Our mutual friend and seriously great guy, Peter Bloom, brought us together, which eventually led to this CNAS paper that we wrote together called Separating the Threat from the Hype, What mm-hmm. Washington Needs to Know About Cybersecurity. I thought it was great work, but did it make any difference at all?
Maybe I can answer personally. It certainly made a difference in my personal life. I think that getting to know a guy like Peter who has immense credibility as a partner at General Atlantic, who also is a committed public servant in his soul, mm-hmm. interested in the issues of our time, spends his time, his energy, his wealth, relationships on helping address really big issues and problems in society. Getting to know Peter had an impact on me, getting to know you, writing this paper together, and really, I was the junior partner writing this paper. Let's be honest, you were the senior partner, and it fired my interest in the topic.
So the fact that it didn't work is really my fault, is what you're saying?
I was hoping to slip that in, not be challenged on it.
Yeah, sneaky bugger.
There are no silver bullets here. I think it's one contribution to the conversation, and it inspired me to get involved in this professionally and to try to get more engaged in what I think is a wave that is just continuing to build, and it's affecting every aspect of our society.
Right. There is a silver bullet, by the way. You're on it right now. But it's a podcast.
Indeed.
It's an ironically named podcast. So, I've heard about this silly Estonia DDoS attack so many times, and I always hear about it in Washington, where they really think that the internet is a series of equally sized tubes that everybody has,
right.
and don't
yep.
understand that Estonia was attached through a straw or maybe a set of semaphore flags. So tell us why your definition or our definition of cyber war requires this kinetic impact, and so hook it back into the earlier part of this conversation.
I think that you take what happened in Estonia. Look at what's happening in the Crimea, for instance, very recently in the Ukraine over the last several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We are learning. I draw a positive lesson here. We are learning not to rattle our kinetic saber in response to things that are happening in the cyber realm.
Right.
And the U.S. never deployed a ship, didn't deploy aircraft, didn't escalate the conversation that way because of what was happening in the cyber domain. Now, I don't think that obviates a requirement for our government to have a full set of cyber tools at its disposal. Mm-hmm. But like most things in the Department of Defense, I think they're best used as deterrents. Because once you take the lid off Pandora's box and you fire the first shot in whatever domain you're operating in, you lose control pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And having lived that a couple of times, I'm a believer in deterrence through strength, and it does require strength. But I have this the practitioner's visceral discomfort with actually throwing the punch.
Right, right. Very well stated. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So the national security establishment, in my view, is pretty darn enamored with cyber offense and hacking and spying and pwning and all that stuff. And they have some pretty serious confusion about what constitutes defense. What about defense? What do you think defense should be like in cybersecurity?
Well, I think it starts, Gary, with your mantra, build better software. That's if there were to be a silver bullet, that's maybe as close as we get to it, right? And I maybe turn a question back on you and ask whether that's an achievable goal or whether it's a goal that will always recede in front of us, but we'll simply get better and better, or hope we get better and better. Beyond that, I think we have a little bit of a skill set, imbalance in a way, in the sense that the ability to do harm on the offensive side is becoming increasingly commoditized. The barriers to entry are coming down around the world.
Right.
And you see it in the marketplace. You see, companies that had been operating in that space all of a sudden having to compete with Romanian teenagers and making business decisions to change their focus.
Yeah,
right?
When building a cyber weapon just for one-time deployment to aim at whatever and destroy it only costs $5 million, you can see that's just too cheap. Economically, everybody can do that.
And I'd layer on top of that the fact that I think we'd all be better served if we could make defense cool, in the same way that offense has this aura about it.
I call that the NASCAR effect. There's a reason there are a lot of NASCAR channels and zero Volvo car safety channels.
Mm-hmm. So. One of the things that I find interesting just at Endgame and in what we're doing is trying to take a mission focus, trying to draw on really great talent and turn that team and turn those technologies on the defensive side of the equation.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about attribution a little bit. Even if we scrutinize the Snowden documents, and I know this because I've talked to Bruce Schneier, who has done so, it's very clear that the attribution problem on the net has not been solved. Yeah. So as a warfighter, I want to ask you, with your warfighter hat on, why does knowing exactly who's attacking you matter?
It only matters if you're going to fight back. If you're only defending yourself, it doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
If we're talking about if we're talking about building better armor on our tanks, it doesn't really matter where the inbound shells are coming from.
Right.
If we're talking about missile defense and the Strategic Defense Initiative and everything that flowed from it, you don't necessarily need to know where the shot came from.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to retaliate, if you're going to fight back, then attribution becomes essential.
Aha, that's a really important distinction. I love that. I'm gonna have to steal that idea.
So, and then you're in the realm of warfighting, and you better be careful if you think that anything has changed. I am always skeptical when somebody says, this time is different, because you know what? This time is never different.
Right.
And on the warfighter side, as soon as you're talking about firing back, you really need to learn. You need to abide by a couple of principles that are intrinsic to how we as Americans fight, and intrinsic to how I would argue responsible forces have fought, going all the way back to Thomas Aquinas, who is really the font from whom these two principles flow. The first of them is non-combatant immunity. If you're going to fight back as a state using sanctioned power, where the state has a monopoly on the use of force, on the legitimate use of force, you have to do everything possible to make sure that you're not impacting non-combatants. And
right.
The second is your response must be proportional. Somebody can't punch me in a crowd in Iraq and I reply by firing my M4 at them.
Right.
There's a sense of proportionality. There's a sacred tenet of non-combatant immunity. And let's acknowledge those, and now we can have the conversation around how achievable those things are in the cyber realm and what it looks like.
Exactly. So I think that many people that are thinking about offense in the cyber realm are naive about what it means to throw a punch or, you know, to launch a missile or to start a war. And I think it's worth talking about these kinds of the differences here. So I think that real cyber defense, as we've discussed, is based on software security and software engineering and security engineering. And that can act as a deterrent for three reasons. Number one is no first strike's ever going to be decisive in cyber. Number two, we have to have defense anyway. And number three, if we outspend our adversaries now on defense, on the real sort of building security in defense, then we can have that set up as a deterrent for war that also puts us ahead in the game. So you with me on all those three points?
I agree with all of those things, and absolutely. And I would add just one thing to clarify on my end, and maybe this is a point of disagreement for us, maybe it's not, I don't know. I'm curious to see. I do draw a line between the commercial world and the government world when we talk about offense. And in the commercial space, I think, you know, for the reason I said earlier, if you're gonna kick the proverbial hornet's nest, you better kill the hornets.
Right.
I just believe that the government in a world governed by the rule of law, governments ought to have a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. Otherwise, it's murder.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want companies going on the offense.
Right.
I do believe that our government ought to have a full suite of tools at its disposal. I'm not a nuclear abolitionist, for instance. I don't think the U.S. government should get rid of its nuclear weapons, because we live in a dangerous world, and their deterrent value, or their deterrent power, has value to us.
Right.
And so, given that we can't always set the rules, given that we can't control the actions of others, I do think our government should have a strong offensive capability. How we use it, in my mind, is a separate conversation.
Yeah, I actually agree with you on that point. And I want to get at that point a little bit more deeply with the following question. So the NSA is currently set up at sort of cross purposes. We ask them to spy, which they're exceptionally great at. And you know what? I don't have a problem if our spies are good at their job. There are spies. But we also ask them to secure our cyber systems, which makes spying more difficult. That is, if everything's busted and there are vulnerabilities everywhere and everybody has a cell phone in their pocket that's insecure and everybody has a laptop on their desk that's insecure that can be turned into an instant monitoring post, then why on earth would you, as the people who are supposed to do the spying, want all that stuff to be fixed? So we're asking these guys who are our own people to work at cross purposes, which is basically impossible. And they have to strike a balance, which is not a possible balance. What's a better solution?
Boy, I can agree with you on the problem statement. I'm not sure I have a better answer. I think, you know, what we're seeing here, though, is the, you know, this gets back to those vectors moving at different speeds. Go back 30 years or 40 years, you could actually target collection outside the United States. You know, remember during the Cold War when the U.S. had submarines that were tapping undersea cables, you know, where you were actually accessing data or accessing information, conversations that really were only happening outside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And now with with the global distribution of software and just the way our global communications architecture's changed, it's becoming increasingly difficult to isolate collection in any geographical location, right?
That's right. Plus, we do, you know, ridiculous things on purpose, like bounce stuff off of Canada to make it international traffic.
So this is, the world's changed. Technology has changed. Norms have changed faster than law and policy.
Yep. So we need our policies makers to understand this stuff, and that's where I have trouble as a technologist. On the commercial side, when I go in and I talk to the board of a major multinational bank, they actually listen and they change what they do. But when I do, quote unquote, the same thing for the government, nothing happens. It's very frustrating for a tech guy who's used to running really, really fast.
Right. And are there things, I think there are things that our government's going to have to do in the cyber realm in order to pick up the pace, if it's going to work constructively with technologists and with the private sector. What concretely that looks like is an interesting conversation, but it would be great if there was better interflow of people. Mm-hmm. If we had a personnel system in the government that was actually appealing for people to come spend a couple of years contributing. Maybe we need a cyber-focused, federally funded research and development corporation, something like RAND in Santa Monica, California, was for the nuclear era, the 50s and 60s,
right.
The genesis of RAND, and a lot of great thinking that came out of that organization. You can imagine something that is focused on cyber where, you don't even need to be clearable. You can have a very diverse group of people. You don't have to wear a dark suit to work. But it's a way to try to improve the tidal ebb and flow between the two worlds. Cause right now it's just not good enough.
Right. So let's turn to this in-game thing. Clearly, based on our conversation, you and I share a similar philosophy about cybersecurity and the way to approach it and the, responsibility of offense and defense and so on. Now that you're the CEO of Endgame, you've turned the, quote, black water of hacking into a force for good in the world. I got to tell you, when I first found out you went to Endgame, I was like, what is going on? I thought I knew this guy. But I think what's happened is adult supervision is happening and things are changing. So can you explain that to us?
I'm happy to. I think that Endgame's had a core of great talent from the start, actually, and awesome talent, some awesome capabilities and products, and a group of customers who've loved the company and the people of the company they've been working with, mm-hmm. and that's been a pretty solid foundation to build on, very solid foundation to build on. What we're doing now is just recognizing, I don't like corner cases. I don't like needing to thread needles or swim against the current. We're just starting with the basic proposition that we've got 9 billion things connected today, right? And that's going to grow to 40 billion things by 2020. So you've got massive device proliferation. With that comes increasingly complex, dynamic, data-rich infrastructures, massive data proliferation. And so security, like everything else, whether it's, retail or, everything in our lives, is increasingly a data analytics problem, or it has a data analytics component. Mm-hmm. And so you have the first generation of security tools was basically predicated on keeping the adversary out.
You protect the broken stuff from the bad people is how I put it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, good luck with that, right? And the second generation then started to look inside your own network, recognizing that the adversary was in, but it was largely like trying to drive your car while looking through the rearview mirror, right? Log-based, signature-based. You may have a great library, but by definition, they're all yesterday's threats.
Right.
So how do you start to get prescriptive or diagnostic rather than forensic? And so what we're trying to do here is merge together analytical capability with security sophistication to deliver the next generation of this security intelligence and analytics. So our past as a company actually positions us to do this really well, because something we've been doing in with our customers for 4 years has been ingesting lots of multidimensional data, enriching it and correlating it at scale, and then creating actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. So it's an evolution for sure in the company, and it's been a great, I've learned a lot in the last year and a half.
I bet you have. And I'm glad you're turning it into a force for good too. Last topic. So I read your Poetry Foundation piece this morning. And all I can say about that is wow. But I want to ask you, why are liberal arts important for business and military leaders?
Oh man, that's a great question. I'm on the board of my alma mater now. I'm on the Dartmouth board, and find myself spending a lot of time as somebody who is, you know, in the military with a classics degree and now running a technology company with that same classics degree, trying to articulate this. And
don't worry, I have a philosophy degree, so I know where you're coming from.
In my mind, it's a couple of things. One, it is the basic tenets of leadership don't really change, and I think that one of the most important things you can do as a military officer or as a CEO, and I joke all the time with my crew, CEO stands for Chief Explaining Officer, not Chief Executive Officer. It is to explain and contextualize. Build shared context. Set a vision. Set a direction. Build the context so everybody understands it. And then get the troops marching in the same direction. Spend a lot of time feeling as if I'm kind of steering a wooden boat down a river through the rapids, and I try to swing the rudder enough to avoid the big rocks, but every now and then we hit a rock and a couple of people fall out of the boat and you got to pull them back in. Yeah, you got to patch the hole and kind of keep everybody aboard until you hit the next rock and you do it all over again. And war feels a little bit like that. I think growing a business feels a little bit like that, and that is that's a fundamentally human thing, right? That's requires connecting with people, understanding people, talking to people, communicating with people, in speaking and writing. These are not technical skills. And do I wish I could layer an engineering degree in there for myself? Absolutely. And I spend a lot of time with our guys trying to learn better the intricacies of what they do. But the reality is, it's not how I spend my time, and I don't think it should be. I think we need leaders who are building context and helping their subject matter experts have the direction they need, the resources they need, the support they need to do their jobs well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last question. This has nothing to do with anything else we've talked about. So I sail in the Leukemia Cup every year. In a boat that's captained by my brother, Chris, who's the commodore of the Washington Sailing Club. So, you want to enter a boat next year and get beat by us?
Oh, man, absolutely. Sign me up.
Cool. I like it. You heard it here first. We're going to hold you to that one. Well, thanks a lot, Nate. This has been a very interesting conversation.
Gary, it's been a lot of fun for me. Enjoyed being on. Thank you for the invitation.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The January-February issue of IEEE Security and Privacy magazine includes articles about Snowden and the NSA, smart car networks, and our interview with John Callis. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.